Thanks for joining us. I'm Steve Roberts, sitting in today for Diane Rehm. Presidential rivals John McCain and Barack Obama marked the 7th anniversary of September 11th by refraining from airing political ads. They appeared together at Ground Zero and separately at a forum on national service. Sarah Palin has her first extensive interview with a network news outlet since becoming John McCain's running mate. And regulators hope a rescue of investment bank Lehman Brothers will not involve public money. Joining me in the studio for our Friday news roundup are Stephen Hayes of the Weekly Standard, Gene Cummings of Politico, and David Korn of Mother Jones Magazine. Welcome to you all. Nice to have you.
Good morning.
You can join our conversation at 1-800-433-8850. And, of course, our email is drshow@wamu.org. Give us a call. Join the conversation. But let's start here in the studio, Gene, with Sarah Palin. The long-awaited interview, finally sat down with Charlie Gibson of ABC News. First time she really answered questions of any kind since she's been a candidate. How did she do?
Well, I think she did pretty well for herself. She didn't make major mistakes. She made some. But there are no screaming headlines today. It was one of her toughest areas to be questioned about, foreign affairs. And she got through it, I think, pretty much intact. And like I said, she did make mistakes. And, you know, it seemed at times that she had been memorizing and studying information and didn't have some of the nuances down that would come if you had complete familiarity with the topics that you're talking about. But overall, I think she did pretty well.
David, your take.
Well, I think stylistically she did. But I think, you know, the bar is pretty low, it seems. I mean, she did make mistakes, but also she, you know, was a lot of spin. She denied that she ever denied global warming was connected to human activity. That's kind of a lie. She said that to the Anchorage newspaper not too long ago. She sort of blew off, you know, her experience, the question about her experience by saying, well, you know, many vice presidents have never met with a head of state, which is really not true, as ABC News quickly fact-checked. And when asked about foreign policy, you know, part of her answer was, well, we can see Russia from Alaska. So, I mean, I think putting all this together, I mean, she looks good. She's memorized her talking points pretty well, but there didn't seem to be much sort of fluidity with foreign policy. She couldn't think off the dime. And so it's quite clear. I won't say that an objective person won't come to this conclusion, but it's quite clear she is not ready to be commander-in-chief tomorrow, which was the standard John McCain set for himself. So to me, that's a key question, and she didn't pass that test.
Steve Hayes, your take.
Well, I obviously disagree with David. I thought she did reasonably well. Agree more with Gene's take. I thought she did reasonably well. I thought she talked about foreign policy in a way that corresponded quite closely with John McCain's broad worldview. I thought she handled some of the trickier questions pretty well without looking like she was dodging. I didn't get the sense as I was watching her that she was, you know, nimbly trying to avoid answer questions. She spoke in broader terms than probably Joe Biden would after being in the Senate for 3 decades. But I thought she handled it well. I thought the questions were fair. It's been interesting for me to see the reaction today and the differences in reactions between conservatives and liberals. Conservatives, I think, thought that Charlie Gibson asked questions in a prosecutorial tone and that the interview bordered on unfair. I'm a conservative. I don't share that view. I thought he hit the mark pretty well. I thought he was tough, but I thought he was respectful. I think you have some on the left, I've heard this morning, who say, boy, he really didn't go after her the way that he could have, which I think it's interesting. And I think what it highlights is the cultural divide that the Sarah Palin question presents.
And the intensity of the emotions on both sides, right, Gene?
Absolutely. I mean, if for Charlie Gibson to get it from both sides means he walked down the middle of the street just about right. You know, I mean, there's going to be more of this interview to be aired. So it will be good to see her with other questions and see how she manages them. But I do think this was tough. I think definitely the bar was low, but any big mistake would have been really highlighted and emphasized. And so for her to get out of there without one of those, I just think she's got to feel
quite
relieved.
Well, she didn't seem to know what the Bush Doctrine was.
That when she dodged question, I thought that was probably one of the lower
points. I don't know how she, maybe she was getting an iced tea during that part of the briefing, but she clearly didn't know, and Charlie had to explain, and then she sort of found her footing. But, you know, most people who would understand what the Bush
Doctrine meant. Well, I actually had a different take on that. I mean, I think that's certainly one interpretation of that exchange, the Bush Doctrine. He asked her about the Bush Doctrine. She went back at him and said, in what respect are you talking about the Bush Doctrine, Charlie?
She clearly didn't have a good
answer. Yeah, it was pretty inartful.
It wasn't aspect of the Bush Doctrine are you talking about. It's like, what do you mean, Charlie?
No, she said, in what regard are you talking about the Bush Doctrine? That's pretty close to a direct quote. What I think is interesting about that is that the Bush Doctrine is open to interpretation. It hasn't been defined in that serious way. And in fact, Charlie Gibson, when she went back to him on it, said the Bush Doctrine, in effect, was this policy of preemption. Well, I've written about the Bush Doctrine for years, and I write about the Bush Doctrine in an entirely different way. I write about the Bush Doctrine as treating terrorists sponsoring states the same way we treat terrorists. There are other interpretations of what the Bush Doctrine means precisely. I think it's entirely reasonable to conclude that she was pushing him to define what exactly he meant before she answered.
It's not as if George Bush ever put out a white paper saying, here is the Bush Doctrine. You know, it is a subject to some interpretation. But, Gene, I want to ask you about something else that Sarah Palin said yesterday. She attended this ceremony, the departure ceremony, for the unit that her son is serving in to Iraq. And she clearly linked the mission with the fight against the people who attacked America on 9/11. This is an old line from the Bush administration, which they themselves no longer defend as factual. And yet she brought it up again. What was your reaction?
Well, I think that if she was going to misstep yesterday, she didn't do it with Gibson, but that was a mistake. And this has been an argument that's gone on in Washington for a long time. And as you say, the administration has acknowledged that Iraq did not plan the attack. And that was where her language was particularly off. Because there are those who can make the argument, and McCain still does, and believes that Iraq is an important part of the war on terrorism. But, and obviously September 11th was, you know, sort of our wake-up moment in that. But there isn't any evidence that Iraq planned the attack. And so her language in that regard was wrong. And that will invite, you know, some to criticize. But frankly, if you are talking to the conservative base of the Republican Party, they believe that. Many of them believe that. And she is articulating a thinking that exists out there, and especially in the base that she is trying to energize and represent.
What do you think, Steve?
Well, if I could just jump in, since I've spent a lot, I don't mean to be particularly confrontational this morning, but I think that one of the reasons she makes that argument is because, in fact, Iraq was a state sponsor of terror. They were well known to have sponsored terrorists for years. The captured Iraqi documents that were put out by the Pentagon back last spring.
But not Al-Qaeda terrorists.
Yes, Al-Qaeda terrorists.
No,
There were at least two dozen senior Al-Qaeda terrorists in Iraq before the war, operating freely in Baghdad.
That's not
indisputable.
That's not the same thing as saying, you know, we went to Iraq to get the guys who got us. The guys who got us are now, you know, in the no man's land between Afghanistan and Pakistan, and it was the Taliban. It was the war that, you know, maybe you won't acknowledge, that was diverted to Iraq.
Okay, let me move on here because I want to ask some more political questions. Another thing we learned this week is not only did Sarah Palin generate enormous crowds and enthusiasm, 23,000 people here in suburban Virginia, but now we hear that looking forward, the Republican campaign is going to do something unusual, or at least contemplating, and that is have the president and vice presidential candidates campaign together. Normally they split off, which is what the Democrats have done. Steve, what's behind this decision? What's behind this thinking, significance of it?
Well, I think the extent to which Sarah Palin has energized the conservative base explains this decision almost entirely. You had for months, really, since John McCain effectively won the nomination, you had this so-called enthusiasm gap where conservatives were not excited about supporting John McCain. And in fact, you know, when I was traveling with McCain, at virtually every town hall he went to, you would have a conservative stand up and say, Senator McCain, give me a reason to vote for you. Give me something. And McCain, being sort of the old combative type that he is, would often respond by saying, look, we're going to disagree on global warming. We're going to disagree. I think Hillary Clinton is a good senator. And he would sort of engage these conservatives in such a way that would further antagonize them. Then you'd go talk to them after these town halls, and they would be, you know, even more upset, less likely to vote for him. Sarah Palin has effectively wiped that out. She has changed the dynamic of the race, in particular because of his support now from conservatives.
You know what she is, Steve? She is the lipstick on the pig. I mean, she is. I mean,
well, in fact, when Barack Obama said that, he said, when he used that somewhat inartful phrase, he said, "I meant to describe Sarah Palin as the lipstick."
Yeah, no, I mean, John McCain, you know, was the pig to a lot of conservative voters. The day after, 2 days after she was picked, a lot of us were flying out to St. Paul, and I was on the airplane with Tom DeLay and Gary Bauer, two well-known social conservatives. They had just
two come, of your closest
my
friends.
Closest pals. We go out drinking all the time. I can't tell you what they do. They're wild men, but they had both been at church that morning, and they were saying that their fellow parishioners were coming up to them and saying, "Finally, a reason to vote for John McCain." He was sort of a dog to conservatives.
But very quickly, David, also two other possible factors here. One is they don't want to be embarrassed to have Sarah Palin get bigger crowds,
which she would,
John McCain, and also. Talk also very quickly about their ability to control her. We talked about the fact that she's still an amateur at a lot of this.
Well, the interesting inside point here is that if she travels with John McCain, she doesn't get her own separate press corps, and they don't need a whole separate, you know, army of aides to manage her with that interaction with the press. So she's much more within the bubble, much more controllable or guidable. And I think the reason you said, too, I mean, it makes John McCain look better to have her there. So we don't know if they're going to do this, but there is a lot of reasons to do it, and it shows the weakness at the top of the ticket. But maybe this will be one instance where the bottom of the ticket has an impact.
And Jean, very quickly.
There are downsides, obviously, to this. Sarah Palin has one big job that they had already assigned her, and that was to attend a bunch of fundraisers. McCain obviously doesn't want to go along, and they can't cover the same amount of geography.
More on this and your phone calls and your comments when we come back, so you stay with us. Welcome back. I'm Steve Roberts, sitting in today for Diane, and as usual on Friday, our news roundup. Joining me today, David Korn from Mother Jones Magazine, Gene Cummings of The Politico, and Steve Hayes of The Weekly Standard. Call us, 1-800-433-8850, drshow at wamu.org. And Steve, yesterday, we had this break in campaigning, but that was a very brief moment. The campaign has gotten very tense very quickly. One of the reasons being that every national poll agrees it's a dead heat. There's just no room between these two. Give me a sense of looking forward here, where you see this going. What are the key moving parts here? What's going to perhaps affect this dead heat in one way or another?
Well, I think really the crucial question right now is whether John McCain holds independence. We've seen Sarah Palin, as we discussed, I think rally conservatives. So I think you have a sense that conservatives who may or may not have shown up at the polls are now much more likely to do so, which I think was one of the two things that John McCain had to do as of midsummer in order to win the election. The other was to win over independents. And you've got some polls now showing him with a 15-point lead among independents that a lot of people are attributing to his selection of Sarah Palin. So I think that, you know, seeing whether that holds, whether he's able to maintain that kind of an edge, I think is really the way that will determine who wins.
And Gene, one of the key elements of independence or the votes of women, and perhaps of all of the polls, one of the most noteworthy findings was in an ABC poll this week, which said that white women had shifted from an 8-point pro-Obama stance to a 12-point pro-McCain stance, and 80% of white women with children at home had a favorable opinion of Sarah Palin. And three of the most important words in American politics today are, she's like me, which a lot of women are saying about Sarah Palin. Give me your take on that dimension of the election.
Well, the ABC poll did show that big swing, but there was another poll this week from NBC and the Wall Street Journal that didn't have as wide a swing, and I think most people believe that's a little closer, that the swing in the ABC poll is too big. But no doubt about it, she's authentic. Voters this year are looking for change. They're looking for something non-Washington, and her authenticity is a good thing in her candidacy, and it's attractive to women voters and to independent voters. Now, we'll see where we go from here, but we have a lot of moving parts and a lot of time. First of all, I think that putting her on has energized the base, as Steve said, but John McCain has yet to make the true argument that he's the change candidate. If you look at the NBC poll, it's still 52% of voters say Obama is change, 35% McCain. So he's just started that argument with the voters or that trying to sell it. We'll see if it sells. I don't know that it will, but they need to do that if they're going to win a change election. And then you also have new allies now coming to Barack Obama's side, most important Hillary Clinton. She's heading into Ohio.
Hillary and Bill, who announced yesterday, and President Clinton
is out there as well. That helps enormously for Barack Obama. And the one thing about that, and that could be one of the big downsides of Palin and McCain campaigning together. As I said, they can't cover the same geography, and they can't leave Hillary Clinton, Obama, and Biden to go work Pennsylvania while President Clinton, you know, goes and works Ohio. I mean, he's got a lot of strong surrogates that he can now spread around the country.
And David, there's been a sense in the last week or two among Democrats of a certain despondency, some criticisms of Obama of not being sharp or tough enough. What's your take about where Obama is now, what he needs to do going forward, and particularly talk about the economic issues. 2 out of 5 Americans say it's the most important issue in the it doesn't get discussed very often. Give me your view.
Well, I think people wanted Obama fans wanted to see more of a bounce after the Democratic convention and see less of a bounce after the Republican convention. And basically everything came back to where it was before both conventions, which was even most polls and national polls. And I think the Sarah Palin choice sort of, you know, threw people off their game and sort of called for some more, a new type of calculation about what this meant. I also think that they saw the in the last week, the McCain campaign really get, I think there's no other word for it, a phrase, down and dirty. When you run an ad accusing your opponent of supporting the teaching of sex education, comprehensive sex education to kindergartners, and it's a blatant lie, it's just not true. You know, people who support that candidate, support Obama, say they want to see him hit back. You know, if McCain's being dishonorable in these ads, then they want to see more of a fight. Now, I think Obama has some problems, you know, fighting too hard in a certain way. He promised to be above the fray. So did John McCain in a way. Obama more so, I think his appeal was post-partisan. And I think, quite frankly, in America, you know, the role of the angry black man doesn't take you too far politically. I think part of Obama's appeal was that he was a new sort of leader from that community. And so I think he has to find a way to answer these charges, because you can't let them sit without getting too mad about it, without being thrown off his game, because he has to make the case, as you said, to the voters about his own case. And that is on the economy, and that's on change, it's on foreign policy and all that. It's a lot to do. And Gene said there's a lot of time left. I think, you know, there may not be a lot of time left. There's a lot for him to do in the time that's left.
Well, there is a lot for both sides to do. But in analyzing, you know, where do we go from a tie to a victory? And when Peter Hart, who did that NBC poll, Wall Street Journal poll, when he analyzed it.
A Democratic pollster.
And when he sort of analyzed what the figures show, it said McCain has come up. McCain has been moved up strongly by the Palin pick. Obama hasn't necessarily gone down. His numbers are about the same as they were. If not, they've gotten stronger. So we head into this final lap, and it's probably going to be all about that first debate. That it's just going to be unbelievably critical for Obama to achieve some of the things that David was speaking about, you know, be forceful and make his case, or, you know, this thing could slip away.
I mean, he did it on his speech. I think his speech at the convention got a lot of those, got that balance right.
Steve, I want to ask you quickly, and then I want to move on to some other subjects, but there are some numbers that have to be out there bothering or at least threatening the McCain campaign. I say the numbers are 4, 6.1, 47, 4%, $4 gasoline, 6.1% unemployment, 47 million Americans without health insurance, and 80% who think the country's headed in the wrong direction. How does McCain run as an insurgent when he's been in the Congress for 26 years and the bums he wants to throw out are in his own party?
Well, the bums he wants to throw out in many cases don't like him, which I think which I think helps. I actually would say take those four numbers that you just gave us, and I would say that you're right that he has to talk about three of them, although I think everybody is surprised that we haven't talked more about health care. I mean, sort of the missing issue in this presidential election that was, I think a lot of people thought would be decided in some way on health care. But I think in McCain's case, the most important number may be the $4 gallon of gas. And McCain, what I think the McCain campaign did rather deftly was he blatantly flip-flopped on offshore drilling, just changed his position, said, we need to do this now. We are at a point where this is an urgent problem. We need to take care of it. And I think a lot of voters see $4 gas, or see the lowering of gas prices as a proxy for a healthier economy. Now, there are plenty of reasons that that doesn't work, but when people go 2-3 times a week and fill their gas tanks with gas that now costs them, you know, in my neighborhood, $3.49 as opposed to $4.49, their sense is that things are getting better and that John McCain was out in front in making the argument, you know, there are all sorts of reasons that gas prices are lower. But I think the sense is that John McCain's willingness to do more may have been one of those reasons.
Now let me move to ask you about Congress is back for a few weeks. And one of the key issues, as you know, Gene, is this very issue. Democrats somewhat willing to concede that the Republicans had captured the drill, baby drill issue, have a package of energy reforms that they are bringing up to the floor of the Congress in the next few days. Barack Obama himself has changed in some ways, his anti-drilling position to say, I'd be willing to accept new drilling as part of a broader package of energy reforms. Congress is going to be dealing with the next couple of weeks. Do you expect anything to happen, or is this simply too political a season for that?
I think it's too political a season. I think what we've got going on the Hill is an attempt to try to either spread the blame or muddy the issue. I think the Democrats acknowledge that the drilling argument broke through with voters. They also recognize that, you know, that they can lift the ban on offshore drilling in September and put it back on in January if they win their races. So of course, the companies can't move fast enough to start anything. So why not just let the vote happen? Well, then they put it in the package, though. And this includes some of the things that Democrats want, which is money for alternative fuel and a bunch of other things. And there are provisions in there that the Republicans don't like. And so what may well happen is that it will pass in the House, it'll go to the Senate, and the Senate Republicans will actually kill the bill. And so then that's how you muddy the water.
And then both sides go to the voters and say,
no, they did it. And the other one says, no, they did it.
David, another economic issue that surfaced this week was new projections on the federal deficit. Government report saying it's going to hit $438 billion. As you think about that, both sides have made proposals that are going to cost a lot of money. Mm-hmm. Barack Obama, taking one example, Steve said there's no conversation about health care, in part because any solution is so expensive in light of this deficit. Is this hanging out there as an issue that basically says to the voters and the candidates, you might have all of these lovely proposals, but the country can't afford it?
Shades of Bill Clinton in 1992. Remember, he had a putting people first program and got in and had to deal with the deficit that had been left to him by 12 years of Republican presidents. This is, you know, We can look ahead, but it's also like maybe one of the final economic legacies of the Bush administration. You know, they keep saying, you know, every year they put out projections saying 3 years from now we'll have no budget deficit. And that third year never seems to really reach us. And now in the final year here, because of economic troubles throughout the country, it may go up even as high as $500 billion. It's doubling what they projected. That's the key number here. And it will tie the hands of whoever is the next president. I mean, if John McCain wants to go to war with Iran and wants to go to war against Russia over Georgia, yeah, after he brings them into NATO, he's going to need more money to do that. We're going to have a draft or enlarge our military, and that's going to be, you know, tougher to do. I mean, you can keep putting things on the credit card, which is what the Bush administration has done with the current war.
But wouldn't that exact same problem face a President Obama
says,
"I want to extend health benefits"?
Yeah, anything. You know, whoever wants to do anything else is going to come in, and you know, it's like you're getting hold of a new business, and you finally see the books. And you go, my God, why did I want this job in the first place?
I'm Steve Roberts, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. Gene, one other major domestic issue surfaced this week was the bailout or takeover or conservatorship or whatever words you want to use of the federal government of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, these two enormous quasi-public, quasi-private agencies that provide a huge percentage of the loan guarantees around the country for home loans and mortgages. Now, a few months ago, the government was saying, all the players saying, we've solved the problem. We're putting federal guarantees behind these two agencies. And now, 2 months later, saying, it hasn't worked. We have to do something more drastic. Quickly, give us a sense of why didn't the first plan work? What does the second plan mean?
Well, the first plan didn't work because, in part, as David said, they opened the books and took a look and didn't like what they saw. They felt like the two companies were over-leveraged and at risk. Then they went out
more at risk than people thought.
Than they thought. Yeah.
Okay.
Because once they did, when they did took the first step, they put the taxpayers on the hook for whether these things went, Fannie or Freddie went down. And so then they had a responsibility, a much higher fiduciary responsibility, to get in there and see what risk they had exposed taxpayers to. And it was a bigger risk than they were prepared to live with. So then the two companies were supposed to go out and restructuring and get more liquidity in their system, and they couldn't do it. And so that was the
problem.
Couldn't
do it because
they
investors did not have confidence in them.
That's right. So that was what I think stimulated the second act from what we've seen. And now the restructuring, you know, now taxpayers really do own them, at least for a while now. And we'll see if they come out of this as private entities again or quasi-government again or whatever. That's to be determined later. But, you know, what's so striking is you had that act and then now the news about Lehman Brothers, which we'd been hearing for a long time since Bear Stearns nearly collapsed, that Lehman Brothers was the second one that was teetering. And that one looks like it could crater as well. So clearly we have not gotten anywhere near the bottom of this economic dip.
And Steve, are we now at a point where everybody says Fannie and Freddie are too big to fail? Lehman Brothers, too big to fail. Is there a limit here to federal responsibility? At some point, or one of these companies or one of these banks, one of these institutions, do people have to say, you made your bad choices, you got to live with them?
Well, good Lord, I would hope there's a limit to federal responsibility. But I mean, I think, you know, David makes an interesting point with his business analogy, because in effect, what you had Fannie and Freddie doing was saying, okay, we made terrible investments. We didn't make wise decisions. We loaded the pay of our benefits of our executives. We're on the verge of failing. Come on, invest in us. You know, we really want your help. I mean, it's not a good business plan. It's not
even
a way
with
to
the federal guarantee behind it.
Even with the federal guarantee behind it, right? But I think the other important lesson that we're learning out of all of these things is that there is no such thing as quasi-public. There is no such thing as quasi-governmental. Those things that are not expressly private sector will eventually become public sector. And I think that's the most likely outcome here.
You know, there's a real funny money game that goes on in Washington, too. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac were big players in Washington. They spent tens of millions of dollars lobbying, you know, for the rules under which, you know, their executives made a lot of money. several of their lobbyists are actually top campaign advisors to John McCain. So you had the spectacle the day before yesterday of McCain going out there and saying, those executives at Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac ought to give back the $20 million a year they were making. What about Rick Davis and everybody else who was helping them do this? But I'm just saying,
let's be fair. Okay. Jim Johnson, who was the chief of Obama's vice presidential vetting campaign, probably the single most prominent example of someone who enriched himself as
he's
president.
Gone from the Obama
Fannie
campaign
Mae.
Now. Okay. While these people are still running McCain's campaign, while he is decrying what's happening there, they are giving him his speeches. And so, you know, there's been this, you know, conservatives love to cry free markets, privatization, and all that, but a lot of them make a lot of money in town lobbying for these sort of organizations.
But to get back to your original question, I think Lehman Brothers is teetering, cratering, whatever, one week too late. Your question was, is there a limit? And I do think there will be one for a couple of reasons. First of all, now the federal government is completely over-leveraged. And so, I mean, if we got Fannie and Freddie and a $500 billion deficit.
And this enormous increase in their potential exposure
on
their books.
Hundreds of billions of dollars.
And the message, at some point, they have to send the message to the market that, indeed, if you make risky investments and they fail, you will fall with it. They have to send that message somewhere. Otherwise, there's no risk.
Sort of like what they're saying to the government in Iraq. Right. Gene Cummings and Steve Hayes and David Korn. We're going to be back with your phone calls, so you stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Pew Charitable Trusts, working to improve the voting process for all Americans at pewtrusts.org. By the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, committed to helping Americans lead healthier lives and get the care they need, on the web at rwjf.org. And by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Details are at gatesfoundation.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The Friday News Roundup, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, says U.S. strategy in Afghanistan is not working. The Bush administration reportedly approved special forces operations inside Pakistan without that government's approval, and Russia sends two bombers to Venezuela. The Diane Rehm Show next hour. Welcome back. I'm Steve Roberts, sitting in today for Diane for our Friday News Roundup. My panelists this hour are Stephen Hayes of the Weekly Standard, Gene Cummings of Politico, David Korn of Mother Jones Magazine. Let me read you some emails from our listeners. This is from Kathleen in Athens, Ohio. The mainstream media, even the so-called, quote, progressive blogosphere, have been obsessed with Palin, lipsticks, and pigs the last 2 weeks. Do your guests think we will lose valuable time discussing serious issues, such as loss of jobs, the shortcomings of injured Iraqi vets, situation in Afghanistan, et cetera? What do you think, Steve Hayes?
Well, I think to a certain extent we did lose that time. I mean, I am one who argued that the first week of Palin coverage was way over the top. I mean, I think some of the things that our colleagues in the mainstream press were obsessed with were both unseemly. They made numerous mistakes. So I think, you know, whether you're talking about from a conservative perspective, having her make her case that she's a conservative reformer, that's lost time. Or from the emailer's perspective, not being able to discuss these issues, that's lost time.
Let me read this one from Robert in Port Townsend, Washington. What are your guests' takes on the value of national polls versus polls only in critical swing states? Obama campaign is calmly saying that the latter are much more important. Is that true, Jean?
Oh, I think that that is true. I mean, in the end, the president is elected through the Electoral College. And so, I mean, 2000 was a perfect example where Al Gore could win the popular vote nationwide but still lose the presidency because of the Electoral College. So we learned that lesson. We were reminded of that lesson just 8 years ago. But
the polls in the swing states are really as close as the national polls in many ways. I haven't seen more than a range of about 5% advantage for anybody in any of the swing states.
Well, they are. The swing states are swings because of that. But still, to have a 5% lead is better than not having it. So, you know, there are in many of the swing states, Obama's got a little bit of an advantage right now. And not so on the national scene. These are all going to keep moving.
Right. One of the interesting statistics I saw this week at ABC News, they took out the 8 true toss-up states for 83 electoral votes and then tried to apportion the remaining. And they got Obama 228 and McCain 227. So even if you look at it from the point of view of individual states, it's still very close.
It's still very tight. And what will be interesting to see is if Obama keeps with his strategy of trying to stretch the map. Because Palin is a major player now, changes the calculations in the old swing states, Ohio, Michigan, Missouri, and Pennsylvania, the ones we're very familiar with. Can they afford to keep trying to flip something new like New Mexico or Montana
or North Carolina?
Right.
David, this comes from Phil here in Washington, D.C. I know this sounds harsh, but it's an honest question. Are American voters really so ignorant that they fall for Sarah Palin's lie about the bridge to nowhere? It is troubling that Palin continues mouthing her, quote, thanks but no thanks claim long after it has been refuted by numerous news outlets. What do you think?
I mean, I think it's pretty amazing. I give the press more credit this cycle than I think in any other cycle for the various fact-checking activities they do. The Post has a fact-check, the fact-checker, there's factcheck.org, there's a politifact.com, and then individual papers and networks do it on their own too. And they have all reached a consensus that when she says, I said thanks but no thanks to the bridge for nowhere, she is not telling the full truth. That is inaccurate, that she went for it. In fact, she went for earmarks that McCain, you know, opposed several years ago. And so that she is not giving a full representation of the story. But yet that seems to have no impact at all on the McCain-Palin campaign. And she keeps repeating that speech line again and again and again because it gets an award. And, you know, I guess we've gotten to the point in campaigns where there's no such thing as a referee. You can, you know, someone, you know, the Washington Post can say foul, but you just keep doing it anyway. It doesn't matter because the audience in front of you probably isn't reading the Washington Post.
Well, I think, to be fair, it's a little bit more gray than you're making it out to be.
Everybody.
For instance, the Alaska Democratic Party at the time criticizing her for eliminating the bridge to nowhere, for defeating the bridge to nowhere. They did that in real time. They did that at the time. Now, I don't think there's any question that she has played up her role, exaggerated her role, changed. She was not as opposed to it at the beginning as she certainly is now.
That's my only point.
On the stump. But, yeah, but you have to say that there is some gray there when the Alaska Democratic Party uses
what she says and evaluating what she says against reality. I don't care what the Democratic Party had to say.
Let me ask Jean to come in here because you work for Politico, which is a paper that is not on one side or the other, but really tries to be down the middle. Talk about the question David raises about the role of the press, its responsibility to be the referee here and to try to hold both candidates and both parties to account for statements that are misleading, even if they keep being repeated, and on either side here.
Well, I think that we are trying to do more of that this year. Going back to the first email about our the media obsession with Palin for a week or so, I think that's expected, but I think it'll never completely go away, or it shouldn't. I think some balance will come where the coverage will go back to a more McCain-Obama-oriented fight, issues-type stories. But Palin needs to be vetted, and she will be vetted by the news media, because it is our job to try to find out what we can about people who want to become president or vice president. And that's our role in this democracy, and we need to do that, and we will do that. And I think the McCain campaign expects us to do that.
Although they said that they expected a press to pay deference to Sarah Palin.
Well,
it's not a word that most reporters...
And they won't push. I didn't say they wouldn't push back. I think they expect us to do our job, and we expect them to do theirs, which is to try to protect and advocate for her.
Let me turn to some of our callers who have been patiently waiting. And Diane from Indianapolis, you're on the Diane Rehm Show. Welcome.
Good morning, and thank you for taking my call.
Happy to have you. What's on your mind?
I think McCain and Obama both mean change, but how can a divided country be united when the change that each half is looking for is very different? For instance, single-payer health care versus private insurance companies, multilateralism versus unilateralism, religious fundamentalism versus separation of church and state, choice versus anti-abortion, exploring sustainable, diverse energy solutions versus leaving no resources for future generations?
Interesting question. Steve Hayes.
Well, first of all, I'm not sure that consensus is necessarily a good thing. I don't think we have to all agree on every issue, and I think that's exactly why we're doing what we're doing now.
Why we have elections.
You want to flesh out. I mean, I would rephrase some of her. You know, I don't think that it's necessarily long-term sustainable growth.
But her longer point is that both candidates talk about bringing the country together, bridging partisan divides. And what our caller is saying is there are very serious differences. It's going to be hard for whoever wins, I think, to do what they say they want to do.
I think that's just an accurate description of reality.
Okay. We'll turn to Randy in Montaway, Ohio. Do I have it right, Randy?
Mattaway,
happy to have you.
Thank you very much, Steve. I always enjoy you and both your wife's comments, too.
That's kind of you. Thank you.
I want to follow up on what your last caller talked about. I'm from the hinterlands, too, and the choice of Joe Biden as vice president completely befuddles us. Why in the world a man preaching change would select one of the most polarizing politicians in this country as his vice president and then expect to unite the country is beyond us. And I'd like your people to comment on how in the world we're expected to believe that this was his real choice.
Can you tell us why Biden is polarizing? Why do you feel Biden is polarizing?
Anyone who has watched his judicial questionings of Supreme Court nominees would know why.
Okay. I think they're talking.
He's terribly bitter. I don't know. He rubs people the wrong way.
Okay, Randy. Thanks very much. I think what the caller is talking about is everybody remembers Biden as foreign relations chairman, but he served a tenure as head of the Judiciary Committee,
right. Where
he was tough in questioning of Republican nominees like Robert Bork and Clarence Thomas. Go ahead, David.
Yeah, but more recently he had hearings with Roberts and Alito, and he was opposed to them to a certain degree and put hard questions to them. I was at those hearings, but I don't think, you know, people in Washington tend to, you know, see Joe Biden as one of the more polarizing Democrats, or, you know, even though he's you know, liberal, left of center in some issues. So I would ask Randy to go back and look fully at the Biden career, and you can find a lot of instances when he's been bipartisan and is, you know, just sort of speaks his mind.
And in fact, John McCain has had some nice things to say about Joe Biden, particularly in terms of cooperating on
the issue of change. I don't think you can make the argument that Biden is more entrenched and more polarizing than John McCain is.
But to be fair, if there are folks that Randy represents, people who supported the appointment of Thomas.
It's the judicial nominee that is the sticking point.
That's right.
There,
and
I
so,
think.
You know, I'm sure that the Obama campaign had to have Clarence, that calculus in their minds. Now the question is, were those voters who would support the appointment of Justice Thomas, would they really consider Barack Obama as their candidate in the long run anyway? And they probably decided those folks really aren't.
But it may be more than that. I mean, I don't know that we know that Randy was a strong supporter of Clarence Thomas, but he certainly remembers the hearings in any case.
And it was Bork as well as Thomas.
And it was Bork as well as
Thomas. The one who actually lost.
But it's interesting. It's interesting to me. I mean, David said, you know, nobody in Washington thinks of Joe Biden as a particularly polarizing figure. I mean, one of the narratives I think that's really emerging in this campaign, first with Sarah Palin, maybe with Joe Biden. I certainly didn't see it with Joe Biden before this, but is this cultural divide between Washington and, you know, the hinterlands, as Randy put it. I mean, there is this sense. I mean, it's fascinating when you talk to people in Washington, whether you're talking about the Sarah Palin selection, whether you're talking about the lipstick on a pig controversy, you know, where I thought that Barack Obama certainly wasn't calling her a pig. It didn't seem credible to me to suggest that she was. And then I talked to a lot of smart people who are from, you know, Wisconsin, where I'm from, and elsewhere, who said, you mean to try to tell me that he was using lipstick, which was her loudest applause line just a week earlier, and that was a coincidence? You know, so there is, I mean, I didn't see it that way, but there is this gap. And it's interesting if it's emerging in other places like a Joe
Biden.
Well,
that's part of what one of our other callers was reflecting, which is a sense of tremendous emotions on both sides, which, as you pointed out earlier, Steve, was not really on the Republican side. There was much more of a sense of lassitude a month or 6 weeks ago. And now, in some ways, the Republicans have been as excited and energized as Barack Obama has energized the Democratic base for a long time. Let me turn to, let's see, Jan in Rockford, Illinois. Jan, welcome to the Diane Rehm Show.
Good morning. Thank you very much for taking my call. I have a question, but I wanted to clarify one statement. The news media said that the lipstick on a pig remark was John McCain's over and over and over again, so Barack Obama utilized that as a reflection of McCain. The other thing is that my question was that on public radio Tuesday night, they were discussing the interview with Palin, and they said that the interview was split, it was going to be taped, and that Palin was going to be allowed to have her, vetters or advisors answering the questions for her before she had to answer the, speak on tape to Mr. Gibson. I'd like to know if that, in fact, is true. And if that's true, why isn't that told when they talk about these interviews? Because anybody can do well if somebody's giving you the answers before you get taped.
Thank you, Jan. I have not heard that. Any of the three of you believe that that is an accurate?
I would actually be stunned. I thought Charlie was a little bit soft in some questioning, but I'd be stunned if ABC News had agreed to any conditions. I think we'd know about it.
Virtually no chance.
I think she has just simply misunderstood. I don't think there's any of us think that, and I don't know if any honorable news person
would bring tremendous discredit to ABC News
would
if they did that.
Yeah.
Clearly they prepped her.
Yeah, a lot of the top McCain advisors flew to Alaska and left John McCain on his own so they could help Sarah Palin get through this.
Prepping is not the same. She probably went through days of questioning and you do that before a debate.
Everybody's prepped before
any kind of big event. I'm Steve Roberts, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. We've got time for maybe one more caller, and let's turn to Alex in Hollywood, Florida. Welcome. You're on The Diane Rehm Show.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. Stephen Hayes pointed out earlier that according to Pentagon papers, there were al-Qaeda operatives in Baghdad, as if that provided a justification for the invasion. But the logic is off. The argument holds no water. After all, there were al-Qaeda operatives in the United States before the 9/11 attacks. I mean, the reasoning is sophomoric.
Let Steve respond to you. Thank you.
Well, we can belabor this point. I don't think we'll ever agree on it. There was a report that came out of the Pentagon in March based on documents that were captured in Iraq after the war that had been authenticated by the Joint Forces Command. Among those documents, it confirmed that there had been al-Qaeda operatives operating in Baghdad, also confirmed that Saddam Hussein had been sending funding and training operatives for Ayman al-Zawahiri, who is Osama bin Laden's number two, as recently as 1993.
I think we have time for one more. Anna in Greenbackville, Virginia. Go ahead. Anna in Greenbackville, Virginia. You're on the Diane Rehm Show. You got to be quick.
Okay. Well, the only thing I have to say is remember when Hillary Clinton was called on about a lie or exaggeration she mentioned about ducking from bullets and whatnot someplace in Rwanda or somewhere where she went? Do you remember that?
Yes, it was in Bosnia,
but
go ahead.
Why isn't Palin called on her exaggeration on the Bridge to Nowhere. Why can she constantly say that when it's not the total truth?
She has been called on it. And actually, the McCain campaign, I believe it was this week, for the first time acknowledged publicly that she did support the project and then changed her position. So, you know, she has been out on the campaign trail using her speech, her acceptance speech, as her talking points. My guess is now that she's had time away, they'll probably suit her up with some new talking points, and we'll see if it continues.
And do you expect, Jean, that as more reporters look into her record, there will be more instances like this? I mean, she is just at the beginning of a period of very intense scrutiny.
Absolutely. I mean, we are learning more and more things about her every day that raise other questions. And there's just going to be this shakedown period as we try to get to know her and try to find out what we can and inform the public. And the campaign will need to respond to those
very
things.
Quickly, Steve, in Republican ranks, is there nervousness that this very inexperienced person about whom very little is known, that there are other things out there? Do they wonder if there are other shoes to drop?
I think there's an expectation that there will be other controversies that come up based on things that she's done, either as mayor of Wasilla or as in her time as governor of Alaska. But I think there's also a sense of relief. Relief might not be the right word, but a sense that Republicans and conservatives are happy that the news media now seem focused on her record more than her family or of these supposed controversies.
Very, very quickly.
Well, I have a story out today, MotherJones.com, about how she might have misused her email to engage in partisan activity when she was the mayor. And it's important because she became known as a reformer in Alaska for going after someone for doing exactly the same thing.
David Korn, Jean Cummings, Steve Hayes, thank you all for being with us on this weekly news roundup. I'm Steve Roberts, sitting in today for Diane, and thanks so much for listening.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Tanya Weinberg, and Susan Neighbors.